And welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
I'm Bill.
You sure, Bill? I can't hear you very well. There we go. You're back
again.
Better.
There we go.
We got here really early, which of course means that, you know.
We didn't know what to do with ourselves.
There's this huge flurry at the end. We're used to coming in on the flurry and then starting off with the flurry. So let's see. I have to do a little promoting here. McDonald's Budget Printing in Reading. They are the best. They're I'll look up their stuff for another break, but if you live in Reading, they are over by the bowling alley. They're right next door to H&R Block on Bocelli Lane. And those guys, that's like the third time I've taken something in kind of last minute. And this wasn't just like, hey, can you make me some copies? It was, can you make me some giant posters of some photos and put them on poster board? And they got it all done. It was awesome. They, you know, got all the artsy fartsy stuff handled. Can I say fartsy on the air? Just kidding. they got all the artsy fartsy stuff done and made it look really good. It was posters of dead cattle, and they didn't even freak out. It was kind of fun, though, having them spread out all over the counter when some lady came in who I think was kind of a pro-wolf person. And I was going to a wolf protest, so I thought, I should make these. I'll use them over and over again. And the pictures were, I was going for gore, carnage, actually. And I think I succeeded. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Bill? You could be my independent evaluator. How was my carnage level?
Made me want to barbecue a steak.
Wolf steaks.
Yeah.
You're supposed to say it made me want to make a coat. I think that's what we were going for. We want to keep the cattle alive. Oh, man. The worst. So, anyway, if you are interested in sponsoring the show, you can go to wethepeopleradio.us, click on the sponsor link. We do have lots of people who just sponsor a little bit each month. It's kind of handy. And we do like to promote our local businesses that help us out with issues and solutions. So, yeah, if you do need printing, go down to Budget Printing there on Bocelli Lane.
Yeah, they really did turn out nice. I mean, it was
They turned out great. And they didn't gouge me. It wasn't like, oh, I should have come in a week ago. You know, we can't get it done. It's going to cost extra. Nope, they never do that. They're always really cool and super helpful. And it's very much, when they say it's a family operation on the door, I mean, they really mean it. You can, and you get kind of involved in the family, which is nice. So, what else do I have? I don't know. Earth Day, the Earth Day guys, I do have one other thing that was kind of funny. The big wolf protest up in that we were launching for Mount Shasta on Saturday, yesterday, let's see, because today is April 27th. So it was yesterday, it was their big Earth Day celebration, and they were having somebody from the Center for Biological Diversity come in and, you know, promote how great wolves are, blah, 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 which they are not. And it was kind of funny because at the last minute, they had to cancel it because of the weather. Climate change went wrong on them. And so they moved it to another, they moved it to the 4th of March, I believe it is now they're going to do, which was just sort of humorous. So not very resilient. Apparently they're all made of sugar, and if they get water on them, they're all melted. So I've got my posters ready, though. I won't have to bother the poor budget printing people for a last minute order this time. All right. That said, this time, I know last time I bungled it when we had Robert Tannenbaum on. I introduced him in the wrong hour, and then we cut him off at the end of the hour. We didn't hear the end of his story. It was kind of one of those days. So today, we're not having one of those days. He is here for the whole time, and we're going to get the entire story this time and not cut him off at the pass, because that was horrible. And I do want to know the end of the story. We asked him why he waited so long to write the book about Lee Harvey Oswald. So the book is called That Day in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald Did Not Kill JFK. And there's been a lot of stuff written about this, but I always want to hear the story, right? I like reading, but hearing the story is always pretty great. And Robert Tannenbaum is the author of 33 books, and I've listed them on the page here for you today. 29 novels featuring Butch Karp and Marlene Ciampi, maybe. I probably got that wrong.
That's good.
Oh, yay. And 4 nonfiction books. I like the names. Badge of the Assassin, The Piano Teacher, because who doesn't want to read a scary book about a piano teacher? Echoes of My Soul and The Cole Country Killing. He's one of the most successful prosecuting attorneys, having never lost a felony trial and convicting hundreds of violent criminals. Three cheers for you. He was a special prosecution consultant on the Hillside Strangler case in Los Angeles and defended Amy Grossberg in her sensationalized baby death case. He was assistant district attorney in New York County in the office of legendary district attorney Frank Hogan. And from reading his bio in the past, we were watching Law and Order, like old reruns of Law and Order, and they were talking about Frank Hogan. And I thought, wait a second, I know that name. And when he was there, he ran the Homicide Bureau, served as chief of the criminal courts, and was in charge of the DA's legal staff training program. Robert also served as the deputy chief counsel for the Congressional Committee investigation into the assassinations of President John F. Kennedy and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Well, let's see. He also did two terms. So now we move to, like, the lighter side, right, which was probably fraught with drama, but he was a two-term mayor of Beverly Hills. Sounds like a fun gig, but it was probably hell. and then just for fun, he taught advanced criminal procedure for 4 years in Berkeley, in the law school at Berkeley. So not everybody who came out of Berkeley was a goofball, apparently. Did you weed the goofballs out for us, Robert, during that time?
Oh, Christ, it was an amazing time. I mean, the last thing I thought about was going to Berkeley, and I went there on a basketball scholarship, and it was a time where in 1961, where I went there in the summer of 61, and spent my college and law school at Berkeley, but I never thought for a minute that it was as organized as it was. There were a lot of good people, actually, who were getting totally different politics from me, but they were getting signatures on in the South for voter registration drives and all those kinds of things that, frankly, I had never heard about. And I was just hoping I could hit the outside jump shot with consistency, if you get my drift. So it was a great experience. There was more to be learned and discussed and argued outside the classrooms than they were really in. But I will say this about the whole experience. Unlike what we're seeing today, not one of my professors, undergraduate or in law school, did I ever detect them trying to proselytize or give their philosophy in the course. It never happened to my knowledge, and I was concerned about that, and I was on the ready. But it just went to show you what the faculty was made up of them. There was respect for the First Amendment. There was respect for other people's opinions, and it was made clearly about who they were and what the opinions were and how the students felt about it and questions and answers. And believe me, I had many an hour of debate with my professors, notwithstanding the fact that, as I said, there was no proselytizing going on at all. And there was just interpretations of what the Constitution had to say, which we can go on forever about. But it was a fabulous experience, and you know, it's always stayed with me. And let me, I can get now to, before I go, you know, I'm in my office, so before I leave here, you said everything that has to be said about me, for crying out loud. It's unbelievable. Is this me you're talking about, or what? Teaching at Berkeley was another phenomenon. I mean, it was kind of a thing where you want to hear other points of view, particularly from the students, and what they're backing it up with. And that's what the exercises were about at the time. And those exercises were, you have something to say it, but make sure you got some research you did here, and you're just not shooting your mouth off the left. So it was that kind of a hit and miss kind of thing. Now, let me answer the first question you asked, if I may. It's exceedingly personal, but I appreciate the opportunity to come back here and speak with you guys. And that is, in 1919, I was diagnosed. I started this book before that. My last book, my novel, Without Fear or Favor, was in 2017. And that was Simon Schuster who published it. And then I had this gap. And my new book, That Day in Dallas, is now scheduled for publication on June 10th, I believe. Yeah, June 10th. They keep backing it out a little bit because the publishers got some, could use some descriptive words for this, but I dare not. I mean, if we're concerned about artsy-fartsy, then believe me, I'm way out of my league. And the publication has been moved up and back and up and back because of the tremendous publicity about these 80,000 pages. You know, and let me start with that for a second. I don't want to insult anybody's intelligence, but would it offend anybody's intelligence if I suggested that for 62 years, our government has lied to us? Our government knowingly has contrived a predetermined conclusion through the pretense of an investigation. And both the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee disregarded all convincing and trustworthy evidence to the contrary. I'll go through all that when we chat about it. But I want you to know what the point of view was that I left Washington with and had no knowledge of it, nor did I have a brief one way or the other before we started this investigation with Dick Sprague, who was the chief counsel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and in October of 76 asked me to come to Washington. He was chief counsel and staff director, and he wanted me to be in charge of the subcommittee investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. The other subcommittee was the investigation into the assassination of Martin Luther King. So that's how I got involved with this thing. And Sprague and I, after we met and worked together, we started January 1st, 77. And as you know, all these select committees have a life of 2 years. So at the end of 78, this committee would dissolve. And before they dissolved, they wrote out their reports, particularly with people who, Sprague and I, we were promised from each member of the committee that they would not interfere with our investigation. And as I said, when we went to Washington, and I never knew Dick Sprague. I didn't know he was legend in Pennsylvania, chief assistant DA in Philadelphia. And when I say for 2 years I tried at least 2 cases a month, that's why I never say how many cases that I tried. It was ridiculous. You do the math. And Sprague is the only person who prosecuted more cases than I can honestly say, with a good heart about it all. Because he's an extraordinary lawyer, brilliant. And what I respected most about him was I was trained by the best, two of the best assistant DAs who ever served for Frank Hogan, and by Hogan himself, who never wavered about doing the right thing. Believe me, Echoes of My Soul is a book all about that. And I was asked to write that book by Mel Glass, who was my mentor in the DA's office because of what Hogan went through in that case, but never mentored, never wavered about the search for truth, even though that search for truth, people in the office for like 20, 25 years told him, take a plea from a guy we know who's not guilty, but no one will know that we locked up the wrong guy. It was a 19-year-old black kid. And the kid wouldn't even know how to get from where he lived in Jersey to Brooklyn to visit his aunt. And you would know that just from talking to him over a very short period of time. But the Brooklyn detectives who questioned him, he fed back to them what the leading questions were throughout the entire process of being questioned for about 17 hours. And the senior staff told Hogan that just take the plea from this guy and we'll wipe our hands of the case and it'll be tried in Brooklyn. And that's when Hogan, and I heard this from Mel Glass, who was present at this meeting, and Hogan stood up and he said, let me get this straight. You're asking me to take a plea from a man we know who is innocent for two murders committed in Manhattan. And you want Brooklyn people to handle his cases. There are two murder cases in Brooklyn involved with this case. And yes, said the staff people, going along with this notion. And Hogan said, well, we know he's innocent also in Brooklyn. What I want to know is, from each one of you, I really want to know this before you leave this room. I want to know, when did it become so corrupt that we would take a plea from someone we know is innocent so that I could save my ass?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I don't know of anyone. I don't know of, this was the case, by the way, because the two girls were murdered, Janice Wiley and Emily Hoffert, the so-called Korea girl murders. You can look that one up. Brutal, vicious case of the killing. I mean, knifing, disemboweling, cutting off necks and so on by the killer. And this was not Whitmore, George Whitmore. And so Hogan's people said, this case is the case. People are, this was, they jumped in, the killer jumped in. through the seventh, through the third floor window in a so-called fashionable Upper East Side, doorman, the whole works. And if people were getting murdered in their third, and the window was open, it was a hot August day in 63 when this happened, and the public was of the state of mind, and this is one time I think I can say the media got it right, is that people were afraid. If that's what happens in a fancy schmancy building, what the heck, where, how are we supposed to survive? And so what they were asking Hogan to do was to avoid having to say he locked up the wrong guy. And that he now took a plea from the guy who was not the wrong guy, but no one would know that. Except he would know it, his staff would know it. And that was something that, when I heard this, of course, I was not surprised. And what Hogan did was, at the end of that meeting, he wanted resignation papers from everyone. And, you know, Glass, he told me that he asked Mel Glass what Mel thought. Mel was only in the office at the time for 6 years, not in the Homicide Bureau, just in the, what we call the Felony Trial Bureau. And Mel said, Mr. Hogan, if you don't dismiss this case, it'll ruin not only your legacy, but your life. Hogan said, get downstairs and do justice, Mel. Mel went downstairs, dismissed the case. A year later, Mel found the real killer. And it's a tremendous story, echoes of my soul. I urge you to take a look at it, and you'll understand what I'm saying. Because if you want to know what DA should be doing in their career, read this book. This is what it's all about.
Wow.
It's not about these political characters who now have so perverted justice. It's so disgusting to me what they've done. How do they live with themselves?
Well, some of these judges just lately, like this last week, I totally thought of you. I thought, I bet his hair is on fire. You know, that you have judges that would usher a criminal out the back door and try to shield him from the police. And
I mean, I never heard of anything like this.
It's crazy.
Totally crazy stuff. And it's mind-blowing to me about when I look at these people. You know, it used to be when I went into the courtroom, always we had on a suit, whenever you went into the courtroom. Now, when I walk into a courtroom on a matter that I'm retained for example, and I don't know who the DA is, who the defendant is, or who the defense attorney is, they all look alike. And I say that
that's not a ringing endorsement.
No, I mean, we're talking about people dressed. They're not dressed for court. And next thing you know, they'll be in basketball shorts walking into the courtroom with a T-shirt. So there's no respect for process, for the things that truly matter. And dress is important. I mean, it's an indication of when you do walk into a courtroom, you look like you belong there the way you should be. But let me go back to this.
Yeah, well,
I'm
immediately, Bill is giving me the high sign on John Fetterman. You know, I mean, look what's happening right in the Senate, right? We got a guy.
Exactly.
We got a guy in a sweatshirt who's representing a state. What the heck?
Yeah.
Robert, we have to take a really quick break, and then we're going to come right back.
I'm with you.
Got a little balled up on the music there. I got here early today, and as I've previously confessed, being early is not all that helpful for me. I'm better on the run. Our guest is Robert Tannenbaum, and we're going to go through like a lot of his different books and stuff today. I put on there that it was part two on the book about the assassination of JFK, but I believe we're going to have a wide-ranging conversation, as we call them. Be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
People think I'm crazy because I worry all the time. If you paid attention, you'd be worried too. You better pay attention, or this world you love so much might just kill you. I could be wrong now, but I don't think so, because there's a jungle out there. There's a jungle out there. It's a jungle out there.
Come a little closer than you see. Come on, come on, come on. Do you understand the things that you can see? Come on, come on, come on. Do you understand the things that you can see?
I bet that would be a great theme song for one of your books if they ever turn it into, if they ever need some background music. It sounds like most of the things you've written about are not exactly what they seem.
So true.
All right, so go back to where we were.
All right, where we were was, you know, why did I wait this long to do this book? And as I, and it's very important also, I have to get the culture into this with respect to what was happening. You know, it's funny you mentioned Fetterman. Clearly, in the most favorable way to refer to him, in my judgment, is bizarre. But given the nature of what is at stake with all these votes, don't think I'm not rooting for him to vote the way I believe he could vote.
Well, I mean, all joking about his outfits aside, honestly, at the beginning, it was like, wait, this is like Weekend at Bernie's. And then suddenly...
He's like the voice of reason.
Yeah, he's like the most common sense guy over there. I'm thinking, okay, well...
Yeah, amazing. If we can say that about him, that's how far down this road we've tumbled, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But it is interesting in that regard. And there's just as I get into, you know, discussing with you why I had changed the nature of this book, and it had everything to do with my perceptions and how things that affect us. We deal with, particularly in writing, that these things aren't just done in isolation. If they are, you're missing the boat. In my judgment, it's all in my judgment. I'm not telling anybody how to live or do or dress for crime. That's their business.
Sure.
But the cultural issue about all this is very fascinating to me. And I'll give you just a couple of quick examples. In the early 60s, three people came to see Chief Justice Earl Warren. Again, keep in mind who these players are. Earl Warren was a political character. He didn't make it through scholarship as a law review student. He was the Attorney General of California. He was involved in the DA's office for a period of time in San Francisco and so on. And three people came to see him. Henry Wade, who was the district attorney in Dallas, and Wagoner Carr, who was the Attorney General of Texas, and Wagoner Carr's lawyer, Leon Jaworski, who we get to know a little bit better 10 years from this period of time. Anyway, they say to the Chief Justice, "We have information that Lee Harvey Oswald was a contract employee of the CIA and the FBI." That's their term. From unimpeachable sources. And the Chief Justice says, "Oh, well, we'll investigate that." Which was a natural thing for him to say, notwithstanding his particular background in law enforcement. And Alan Dulles, who was there, who JFK fired, as you may recall, as a result of the fiasco called the Bay of Pigs. And that was in 1961. And Dulles wormed his way on to the Warren Commission, et cetera, et cetera. And he was replaced by John McCone. And McCone was very much a pro-JFK person. And I'll get to this McCone document also in a moment. But when Alan Dulles said, when the Chief Justice said, "We'll investigate this case," Alan Dulles said, "Wait a minute. What do you think you're doing?" All this is on record in an executive session. And the Chief Justice said, "Well, we'll investigate this. What are you suggesting?" "Well, I'm saying to you that right now, if you have J. Edgar Hoover, then head of the FBI, he'll simply say, 'I checked the records,' and he never worked for the FBI." Hmm. And, you know, he's upset with us because he's already determined that Lee Harvey Oswald is the assassin here, and there were three shots taken from the back in the depository 6-4 window, the sniper, so-called sniper's nest. And the Chief Justice said, "You mean to tell me that if I were to question an agent under oath, he would lie?" Alan Dulles, "If he were a good agent, he would." "Well," the Chief Justice said, "who will he tell the truth to?" Maybe the president. And that's the first part of the culture of what we're talking about here. If we can talk and have a conversation about alleged good FBI agents. And this is such a slam at the FBI because they're so essential in doing what their original, their job is. And that is to root out information and so on and give it to the president. If they're not involved in politics, or so we thought and pray, and that day is over, hopefully. But the bottom line here is we want the CIA, we want the FBI to make decisions from immutable evidence, which I use in all the cases I tried. Immutable evidence, it can't be in any way refuted. It's scientifically there when you have it, audio, visual, acoustics, et cetera, all of which plays a role in this whole thing. But it was somewhat shocking to hear that coming from the Chief Justice of the United States. And then there's another cultural issue that I found incredible, but I want to share with you, your audience. And that is, at the end of the late summer of 1978, remember the House Select Committee on Assassination started on January 1st, 77. Sprague asked me to go down there with him in March in October of 76. And we went down together and worked together. And as I said, the committee guaranteed they wouldn't interfere in the investigation. It took them 4 months to lie to us. And I went to see Lou Stokes in a meeting that, you know, tells you the whole story in a nutshell. Lou Stokes was the chairman of this committee, the House Select Committee. He's from Cleveland, Ohio. His brother was the first black mayor of Cleveland. And Lou was a very good man in my judgment. He was the ultimate representative defense attorney in Cleveland. And I went with him with two subpoenas. And the subpoenas were that based upon the information, particularly that I had from Richard Schweiker, you remember Senator Richard Schweiker, he conducted an investigation and called me up and wanted to give me his file because he had a subcommittee that he was on from Senate Church Committee on the executive committee's intelligence responses to the assassinations of Kennedy and King. And he was in charge of the subcommittee on the investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy. Similarly, that was the Senate side of this thing, and I was on the structure having to do with the House. That was the House Select Committee, and investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. And Schweiker handed me his file and said, "This is the first week I'm in Washington." And you know, I had mentioned, I don't want to forget, sometimes I mention this stuff and it floats around the ether. The reason I had so much respect for Sprague was I was trained, as I said, by the best who worked in that office. Sprague had no training. This was all intuitive and study and work on how you maneuver if round in a courtroom. And that's why I had so much respect for him. Everyone who trained me expected me to do the right thing. And I appreciated that, believe me. But Sprague had a different point of view. Nevertheless, the point of view that I wanted to quickly share from Richard Schweiker, senator from Pennsylvania, he was a middle-of-the-road Republican. And he said that when he gave me the file, the CIA will be obstructionists, which they've already been, and I will tell you in short circuits everything for you, that in my judgment, which you'll get from the notion of the file, that the CIA participated in the assassination of the President of the United States. I had just come from the DA's office. I was running the Homicide Bureau. I was running the criminal courts. In the criminal courts, we had 250 new cases a day, 7 days a week. And that went from, you know, trespassing up to murder. And it was my responsibility to try to get some organization on dispositions so that we could get some quality dispositions on plea bargaining and not plea bargain the whole case away, which is the custom that goes on too much in too many DA's offices around the country. So I wasn't aware of Sprague, as I mentioned to you, and so on, but I sure became aware of him when we worked together. He was everything that you would want to see from someone who had his position. And again, anyone in Pennsylvania who had a murder case, or much less a felony case, would go to see Sprague, the chief assistant DA in Philly. And what Schweiker meant, and what he said to me from the whole issue of who was responsible for what, he said that JFK was shot in the Wright Temple area from the front of the Kennedy limo on the back side of it, that is to say, it's the area where the stockade fence is, and you can detect it when you look at the film. You'll see it's immediately to the right of where Zapruder is filming with his business colleague. And he's looking in that area, because in that area there were shots fired, according to witnesses who were sitting on the grass area, standing around there, right in front of the stockade fence area. And they were claiming that their shots were sailing over their head. So it becomes an important area in this whole case. Again, that Kennedy was shot in the right front temple area, above the right ear, in the front of Kennedy from the stockade fence. And important, obviously, in the whole case when we go through this, because in my judgment, why this hasn't been written about from the point of view of evidence, the evidence is overwhelming now when we go over all this stuff. That, you know, we'll talk about what happened, the truth about Dealey Plaza, for example, and go right through it. So Lou Stokes said to me when I said I understand that there is information, written information from the CIA that explains whether or not the CIA was responsible for the assassination and its participation, or it was a rogue member of the CIA. That was the level of what's going on here. And Stokes said that the majority of the committee is not in support. They're not going to. This is after 4 months. They promised 4 months ago, on January 1st, 1977, that they would definitely, not interfere, because we would not want to be part of an investigation that anyway was tampered with, that lacked search for truth, integrity, and authenticity. And Stokes said to me that the majority is not going to support and give you any of these, subpoenas. I said, why you hire me? I told you not to hire me. During the presentation, I said to them they wanted to see me when Sprague appointed me. And of course, I went down there to meet them. And I was listening to them pontificate about all this nonsense, and I was very worried about this. And I said to him, look, I don't think you should hire me. And the reason is that I believe that the only way the House of Representatives can function is if you have compromise. You can't have, 315 or whatever the number happens to be at any given time, independent executives. That's Article 2, the executive branch. Article 1 is legislative branch. And I will never compromise on search for truth. I will not do it. So I don't think I'm the person you should hire. No, Sprague wants you, we want you, kind of thing. So as I said, it took him 4 months to demonstrate what a lie that was.
Well, on that note, we have to take another quick break, but it just seems that I must have been channeling you, because I have picked an old song that just seems to hit it right on the head. Our guest is Robert Tannenbaum. We're going to come back with him right after this speedy break here at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
I used to sleep at the foot of Old Glory and awake in the dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I opened my eyes, I was a victim of the Great Compromise.
Thought you'd change the weather, start a little storm, make a little rain. But I'm gonna do one better, hide the sun until you pray. I'm a tornado, looking for a soul to take. You're gonna see me coming by the selfish things that you did. I'm gonna leave you guessing how this funnel is gonna hit. I'm a tornado, looking for a man to break.
They said, hey, Robert, how about you compromise? And then you gave him the tornado, right?
Oh, geez, I tell you, I want to go home and visit you guys and just listen to that. have a nice martini in my hand and let it really roll. That's all I can tell you.
I was totally laughing. I'm like, when you started talking about that, I was trying to make you compromise. I'm like, I don't know why that seemed like a good song, but there it is right there. Yeah, because I do.
So true.
I can't even imagine. And you know, we've all been there. You know, you go in, you tell somebody right, straight up, don't pick me if you're gonna, and then they do it anyway, and they think they can browbeat you.
Like, yeah, exactly. Well, they figure, you know, I don't have anywhere to go. It wasn't like I had some jobs lined up. And it just didn't even occur to me because, you know, that I have to stay on because I need the blessed job routine. I hate when I hear that from people, particularly in law enforcement, particularly really good FBI people who have they've compromised themselves, which I would urge them never to do, on their integrity. And that is to say, well, we knew. In other words, if there's corruption in the FBI, which there was from the political appointees of these hacks, I mean, we know who they are and were. They weren't the line people who were out there in the field. But the people who were the FBI people, good people, knew exactly what was going on, in my judgment. And they didn't want to get involved in matters that they were not assigned, because if they did and they searched for truth, they would lose their job.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a family to support. And I understand that and I respect that. But that's not what your job is, particularly when you're in law enforcement. Get another job. Trust me, you can do it. I've lived through it with the whole thing, and I never even thought about it. You know, there's nothing being brave said by me at all. It's just the reality of, you know, going to an interview and answering any of the questions that anyone has, just as we're doing now, and let the four of them see what their chips fall. You know, you don't want to be part of something that is less than sincere, particularly when you're dealing with these kinds of issues, which transcend the average, you know, kind of thing. Was there a shoplift in this case? And all that crap that goes with it. I mean, can you imagine our system today? You can shoplift for $950 and not get arrested? What world are they living in, really? What world are they living in?
Do you think this is where the corruption in the FBI started? Because, I mean, they've always had a stellar reputation as the, you know, the
Absolutely.
Best law enforcement. And
right. And
now it just seems like all you hear about is corruption in the FBI. And I know there's tons of good FBI agents out there. Don't get me wrong. But it seems like the higher they go, the corruption starts.
Do we just promote the bad ones, or do they get bad?
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, the problem is they've so politicized everything, starting Mr. Obama et al., that they wanted to have all this stuff done just the way they do when you're dealing with a Marxist regime. You know, people can say what they want about the worst president ever, but in my judgment, the worst person who ever served in that office was Obama. He understood. He's what I call a Marxist, limited Marxist, to the extent that he knows not to. He knows he's been trained. If you look at his background and read his own materials,
yeah.
He's been trained to in getting engaged in this kind of conduct and be a minimalist and not ask for too much so that he shows exactly who he is. And it's very dangerous. And what he's done is he's corrupted the system in large measure with people who he appointed to the FBI and to the courts, by the way, that we're talking about. And because you have to wonder how these people are judges doing what they're doing. And you know what the equivalency of it is I made a note to myself to mention to you guys. It's like the Emancipation Proclamation, 1863. And it's as if, given these district court judges, all of a sudden they have national prominence. They have the ability to stop everything the president's doing. And they're district court judges. It's the equivalent of someone going to Abe Lincoln, our president, and saying, a district court judge has just found that you are never to mention Emancipation Proclamation again. It's banned. You're banned from that.
Yeah.
Same damn thing.
Yeah, how's that
when
work?
When's the government going to wake up and tell these judges, your jurisdiction extends as far as the courtroom you're in, period? That's what's sickening to me, is how the justice system has been corrupted this way.
Well, you know, you start with the judicial, or not the judicial, the executive branch. You've got corruption there. And then it trickles into the judicial branch. And there's exactly. there's no surprise now that now we're seeing these judges, making their own rules and everybody going along with it. I'm hoping that what we have now is some folks that are going to put an end to this, but it's all trickled down. It's all trickled down.
It's kind of funny too, because what you hear from the left all the time is, you know, the law is the law, and you're like, well, ship's kind of sailed.
It's very sickening because of the children involved in our future and so on. I shudder to think of what's being taught in these schools and how hideous it is to listen to what's going on. I mean, why are people obsessed, and they happen to be so-called Democrats, with kids who are 3, 5, 6 years old and being taught and what, all the sexuality that they want to talk about?
Yeah.
What is going on there? What is going on with these characters? They need to be analyzed. They need to have shrinks at these meetings, I think.
We do have a psychiatrist on next week, the terrorist therapist. She's talking about, you know, all these political protests in the colleges and how they're just, you know, fomenting terrorism here at home.
Precisely. You know, it's almost a joke of the Yankees, for example. They have Aaron Judge. Oh, they say he's so great. The guy cannot hit in October. They should have a psychiatrist on the bench under there. How do you not hit in a month of the season where the only thing that's really involved is the World Series? Gee whiz. How do you, I mean, it's mind-bogglingly incredible what's going on. So anyway, you know, back to our story here. And that story continues for a very, very brief moment on this culture issue that I mentioned. And I just wanted to mention one quick point of view here, and that was in defining, going through all the documents, I ran into President Truman's memo, which I call a memo. It's a document dated 12/22/63, and he indicated, which surprised me a lot. All of this surprised me, I must tell you. Again, coming from the DA's office in Manhattan, running the Homicide Bureau and the criminal courts, come on. And Truman indicated a major misgiving of the CIA, that he was very, very upset with himself that he permitted the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, the main intel organization during the war, and he let it morph into the CIA. And the reason was, he said, the CIA has become operational. And at times they form policy, and they become an arm of the government. And then we have a lot of trouble we've had, he says, that compounded difficulties in several explosive areas because of what the CIA has done. And then there was this McCone document, which is really a kicker here, and I want to mention this because of what the government tries to do with respect to it. As I mentioned to you before, Mr. Rowley, James Rowley, was chief of the Secret Service at this time. This is March 3rd, 1964. And he wrote a letter to McCone, John McCone, who was the head of the CIA, and he became head of the CIA, as I said, in 61, when Alan Dulles was fired because of the fiasco of the Bay of Pigs. Guess what? Alan Dulles' information wasn't exactly right. He said the people would be waiting for the Americans to come in and free them from tyranny. It didn't go that way. And there was supposed to be, this is a wonderful aside, there was supposed to be American bombing, air cover, as they refer to it. And JFK hadn't engaged in it yet, but now he was about to, because the whole thing became farcical. The people waiting on the beaches were not people welcoming the American soldiers. And so Bobby Kennedy, according to my investigative information, was that he got JFK into a private room, and he told JFK, "What is your plan now?" He said, "Well, we've got to use the air cover here, otherwise they'll blame me for the failure." He said, "I'm going to tell you something right now. You're never going to use that air cover." And the president looked at him, frozen in his tracks, and said, "What do you mean?" He said, "If you use the air cover, it'll be no different from what the Japanese did at Pearl Harbor. And then you're not going to do it. It will destroy your life. It'll destroy your legacy. It's not who you are." JFK then left that room and said, "There'll be no air cover." To this day, there are meetings of that whole crowd that blames that was at the Bay of Pigs, and they blamed JFK because he didn't use the air cover. Just so you put all this into context of what's going on. So now we have this Rowley document, this John McCone document of March 3rd, 64, in response to James Rowley of the Secret Service, because Rowley was concerned, as were the people in the government, that the American public was being lied to about who Oswald was and whether or not he was an agent of the CIA and the FBI. So they were trying to cover this up. So in this two-page letter, which is really three pages, the third page is a signature page, McCone refers to the leaks and on Oswald's training and suspect activities. In one page, and it covers a lot of information about Oswald and how he was involved. We knew from the investigation that Oswald, since 1957, was involved at Atsugi Air Force Base monitoring U-2 flights. As you may recall, Gary Powers' U-2 flight was shot down, and the government, that is to say, Vice President Nixon at the time and Ike President, Ike was lied to by Nixon. And no one in Brooklyn who grew up in my neighborhood thinks that's a surprise, by the way, but that's personal. Nixon was involved in saying that we would have air cover in 1959, before the 60 election. And he swore to President Eisenhower that no one had that plane. In order to have that plane, we would have had a mole in the organization. And Ike's response was, let's find that mole then.
Yeah.
And that's how they used Oswald as well. But from 57 on, he was an agent to the CIA and the FBI, and monitoring these flights. And they had Angleton, who was head of our intel internationally, had used Oswald to say, "I am now resigning. I renounce my citizenship in the United States government, et cetera, et cetera. And I have important information." The idea was to get the mole. They never got the mole. No big deal. No, nothing there. But here's what McCone wrote. Because the government has tried to make it a fake. This is what I love about our government. Find information that's contrary to what their whole presentation is, which is a fraud, in this case particularly, and say it's not true. And here's what is true. He says McCone, in response to Rowley's concern about the leaks and the LHO training and suspect activity, I am concerned that if this information in any way is disclosed to the wrong persons, meaning the media, it would lead the media to erroneously claim that the CIA and perhaps others were directly involved in the Dallas action. That's how they refer to the assassination. And then he says, this is on page two, which is basically paragraph 6 of the letter. While the persons involved in the assassination were in the employ of this agency, as well as the FBI, it is impossible to maintain full 24-hour-a-day responsibility over its agents.
Wow.
And now, you know, I read this thing when I first started about 10 times. So what did the government do when they realized that this thing was out there? They claimed that it was a fake. So I immediately said, who in their right mind, by the way, let's assume the government's telling the truth. Let's just make that a crazy assumption here. Who in their right mind, right now, when I just read to you? What, are people walking around Washington who are one of whom was the head of the CIA responding to an important inquiry from the chief of the Secret Service, and someone makes this up? Now, how do we know this is a fraud, this makeup thing? And there was a book written by Dick Russell. He is a person who should be interviewed more. I never met him.
Robert, because we're going to get cut off by the news again.
We'll get a little news break
and a little coffee, and then we're going to come back and have you as our hostage for the second hour. Yay!
All right.
I knew we'd run out of time.
Okay.
You're listening to We
I'm
the
here.
People,
I'm
and
here.
You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm running.